All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we're very happy to be joined today by Ben Radford, who is coming to us from Peru. Ben is a Green Left journalist who is currently right now in Peru, and he's actually been writing quite a lot about, you know, politics in Latin America based on his travels. And so we're having him live on our program as a, you know, special Latin American correspondent to talk about some of the political developments in the Latin American region. So yeah, it's morning here in Australia, but I presume it's in the afternoon over there, Ben.
Good morning, Jacob. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. You've been spending you've been living in Peru for like the past year or so, or maybe past several months. I wasn't sure about the kind of timeline there. But you've been writing quite a bit about some of the recent kind of the political developments that have kind of happening in Peru. So can you give us a bit of an outline about, you know, some of the things you've kind of observed, especially in terms of the current political situation? And you just recently wrote about a transport workers' strike that took place on October 10 to the 12th for Green Left.
Yeah. So yeah, just to give a idea of the general political situation at the moment in Peru. We've essentially had a coup government since December 2022, in a legislative coup that essentially ousted Pedro Castillo, who was a sort of left-leaning president. And so his vice president, called Dina Boluarte, took power and essentially made a pact with all of the most right-wing forces in the political establishment to essentially be able to stay in power, because they essentially threatened to impeach her the same way that they did Castillo. And so to essentially save herself, she made this pact with the right and the far right. And so essentially she maintains herself as the face of the government, but essentially everything is run by the right wing in Congress and who control the judiciary. And so what they've done since then is become increasingly more authoritarian. And Congress in particular has passed law after law attacking the working class, whether it be granting police more powers, whether it be protecting themselves from criminal investigations of corruption, which is currently more than half the Congress people are under investigation for either, you know, serious corruption or, I guess, run-of-the-mill corruption. But, yeah, it's just and what they've also done is done things like defunded community kitchens. And so, yeah, all of these laws that they've passed essentially without opposition, because Congress is controlled by this alliance of the right and far right. This is particularly hurting indigenous communities and women, particularly from Peru's poorest inland regions. And so this has brought along with it increasing unchecked violence. And so a big problem at the moment in Peru is extortion, and particularly against transport workers. Well, not just transport workers, but small business owners. They're all being extorted by various criminal organizations who essentially demand that they pay daily fees, protection fees, they like to call them. But if they fail to pay, they either get beat up, or their business gets burnt, or as with transport workers, their buses and vehicles are burnt if they fail to make these payments. And so it's in this context where in Lima and the neighboring Callao region, which is next to Lima, the capital, transport workers last week announced a two-day strike because they're essentially, you know, fed up with the extortion and the government inaction of doing anything against it. And so this strike, yeah, as I said, went for 2 days, and they were essentially demanding that, particularly that the government repeal a law that they passed in August, which basically modified the definition of organized crime in Peru's criminal code, which meant that it excluded crimes such as extortion, illegal logging, corruption by officials, which essentially means that it was protecting the Congress people that passed this law. It was protecting them from being investigated. And then also, you know, a lot of analysts have said that it actually helps the growth of organized crime. And so, yeah, the strike was overall pretty successful. It shut down most of the city. And then there was also an accompanying protest where they marched to Congress to, you know, demand the repeal of this law that I mentioned, as well as that the government actually take action. And predictably, you know, from this government, the protest was met with heavy police violence. There were dozens of people arrested, a lot of people injured because they fired tear gas canisters on them, and yeah, essentially refused to meet any of the demands of the strikers. And so while eventually the strike was lifted a few days later, there's been announcements of new strikes either in the next few weeks or next month. And they're organizing the transport unions and workers are essentially organizing to try and have a national strike. So yeah, this one was just in the capital, but this same problem, extortion, is happening all over the country. Like in a city called Trujillo, which is further up north, it's estimated that 100%, they did a survey, 100% of the transport system in Trujillo is subject to extortion at the moment. So yeah, that's the context in which the strike is happening and will continue to happen, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty good kind of overview. And I guess just for our listeners, I definitely recommend that you follow kind of greenleft.org.au, I guess, for future developments from Ben on some of these strikes. Another issue I want to kind of talk to you about is because you've another thing you've been you wrote an article about has been, I guess, the whole issue of the climate crisis. I guess kind of living in kind of Peru, you're kind of there's obviously we're starting to see the kind of occurrence of extreme weather events in Latin America, and of course we obviously know what's been happening in the United States with the kind of massive kind of floods in kind of particular states. And so can you tell us a bit about, you know, some of the occurrence of extreme weather events, including Brazil, Peru and Bolivia, and I guess what are your thoughts on some of the kind of structural kind of causes?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of becoming the new normal, these devastating extreme weather events. And yeah, what's happening at the moment in South America, essentially across most of the Amazon basin, which stretches across predominantly Brazil, has the biggest holds the biggest area of the Amazon basin, but also that stretches all the way across to Ecuador, Peru, Colombia, Bolivia. And so what we've seen just this year alone is there's been more than 350,000 fires, which have burned hundreds of millions of hectares across the continent, and yeah, predominantly in the Amazon basin. And so, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have seen the sort of stats of some of the destruction, so I won't go into that. And that is something that's, I guess, rehashed a lot in the headlines of maybe international news outlets and stuff, but there isn't really a lot of analysis on the, I guess, the root causes or the structural causes of these fires. It's sort of just look, there's lots of really bad fires, but what's really key is that the root causes, particularly in the Amazon, is this unchecked industrial expansion, particularly deforestation and predominantly for huge agribusiness. And what they've essentially done is continue to expand and expand into these territories, which are usually indigenous territories. So that's either been through physical violence, land grabs, or essentially lobbying government to let them take over this land. And so that's usually for, particularly in Brazil, a lot of the deforestation is for cattle grazing or to clear land to grow crops like monocultures, particularly soy, which soy is then used to feed cattle. And so what all this deforestation does is it essentially creates these conditions for bushfires, because when you clear land, it leads to desertification, which means that it dries out, trees dry out, the land dries out, there's less water because lots of water is being consumed for cattle and for these monocultures. And then also a common practice as well that these big like agribusiness farmers use is they burned land to continue clearing it and continue expanding the frontiers of agriculture. And so then what happens as a result is then you have these huge fires that then extend not just beyond, not just in the agricultural areas, but then extend to forests that have never burnt before. Brazil has the world's biggest wetland called the Pantanal, and you know, so many parts of that have never burnt before, but now they have burnt, and it's just left, you know, these massive tracks of devastation. And so on the one side, you've got these huge agribusiness corporations that have so much control over so much land at the expense of indigenous people. And then you've also got the governments that allow this to happen, that allow this sort of unchecked development. And in Peru, I mean, I can talk more to Peru, but essentially there's been complete inaction from the government. And then they've now turned around and instead of, taking action to, you know, for example, declare a state of emergency, they sort of held out and refused to do it and essentially turned around and tried to blame indigenous communities for their traditional farming methods and to say that they were the root cause of the fires, when if you actually look at the reality of it, it's the expansion of the logging industry, of illegal mining, of clearing land to grow illicit crops like coca is a big expanding business in Peru. And then even earlier this year, the government passed a law that essentially reduced oversight of the country's forests and weakened indigenous land rights to and, you know, opened the door for further industrialization and logging of these territories. And then also, I guess, zooming out a bit, it isn't just a structural problem that's within this continent. It's something that's being funded by Western, you know, big European banks, big Western powers, there was a Greenpeace report that essentially found that European banks have poured hundreds of billions of euros into these big agribusiness countries to essentially keep destroying the Amazon and keep violating indigenous rights.
Yeah, and I might just make one big quick comment before going on to the kind of next question, because I guess another kind of contradiction with everything you kind of say there, Ben, is, you know, one is obviously it has a lot to do, I guess, with the kind of class divisions that you also see in Latin America, because on one hand, you know, all this sort of big business is trying to drive all these sort of developments. Attempting to kind of drive development into kind of region, because obviously, you know, in Latin America, it's obviously a much poorer than countries within the global north, etc., much more behind in terms of infrastructure sort of developments. But I guess what you often find is they push all this sort of development at the expense of the environment. But of course, working people and the majority within Latin America do not benefit from it. And what ends up happening is you kind of create a kind of new, very kind of privileged sort of middle class within Latin America who benefits from this development. But of course, all the kind of the ruling class and the kind of capitalists. And yeah, do you have a quick comment on that sort of point?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Latin America is some of the most unequal, the country is some of the highest inequality in the world. I mean, Peru, for example, it's something like the bottom 50% of the population control less than 1% of the total wealth of these countries. And the majority of violations of indigenous rights and of land rights all occur in Peru's interior, you know, the highlands and the Amazon, which is where the large majority of agriculture happens, large majority of mining occurs there. So, yeah, what you have is the majority of people essentially having their land taken off them. They're having their water polluted. They're having their land cleared. And all of this exploitation and extraction that goes on, they don't realize they don't see any of the economic benefit of that. All of that money essentially flows to the coast and then either stays with the oligarchy, who essentially usually take a cut before then it being sent off and for the benefit of some big, you know, Canadian mining company or some big Chinese mining company. Like, the wealth, all of this wealth that's extracted from the huge amount of the wealth of natural resources that Latin America has, is extracted and then exported. And then even a lot of the time, so many of these countries then import the products that are then processed overseas, which essentially, like, by middlemen, which adds, you know, 10 times the value, whatever it may be, then that's imported to these countries. And so it's, you know, it's this crazy situation where they lose all of their resources and the wealth that comes with it. And then these countries essentially buy these products back at triple, quadruple, 10 times the price, to sell back in these countries. And, you know, as a result, you've got massive inequality all across Latin America, some worse than others. But yeah, it's sort of a similar story across the board.
Yeah. Now, the next thing I want to kind of ask you about, because you also wrote a Green Left article about this, but I think you've also made some observations about the Palestine solidarity movement. And I guess I want to hear some of your thoughts on how has, you know, given that Israel's genocide in Gaza has gone on for more than a year, what impact has it had within politics in Latin America?
Yeah, so there's particularly been a lot more mobilization since Israel launched, I guess, at a much higher scale their genocide in Gaza. I guess, like we've seen all over the world. But I guess to understand a bit why there's been a lot of grassroots mobilization in Latin America, which I don't know, many people would maybe think that there isn't necessarily a connection there. It's, you know, it's quite far away. But I guess if you look at the history of Latin America, and particularly the role that Israel has played, essentially providing weapons and training to pretty much all of Latin America's most brutal dictatorships, they essentially acted as a proxy for the US when maybe the US Congress blocked the US from being able to send arms to these brutal Latin American dictatorships. Israel would sort of step in and provide this, but then, you know, also of their own accord to make money. And so, yeah, what you have, I'm not going to go into all the examples, but they've, you know, funded provided weapons to regimes in Nicaragua, the Somoza regime, to various military regimes in Guatemala. And, you know, they're collectively responsible for arming the armies and the death squad and the police that have killed millions of people over the last century. And so, yeah, looking at that particular history and Israel's huge responsibility in essentially arming genocidal regimes, is that now you've got all of these indigenous groups, which are essentially like the target essentially of most of the violence. They're now turning around and drawing these parallels between their struggle against colonial oppressors, which is, you know, the process of colonization is ongoing in Latin America. It started with the Spanish, obviously, and then the British, you know, Portuguese, more recently the US, is this ongoing process of colonization. So what they're doing is drawing these parallels, these indigenous groups, between their struggle against the violence and dispossession, and also with the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and resistance against colonial violence. And so at a grassroots level, the situation's a bit different depending on the country. I guess quite a prominent example is Chile, which has had some big demos and some big fundraising events in solidarity with Palestine. And a big reason for that is because they have the biggest Palestinian diaspora, about 500,000 people outside of the Middle East. And so, you know, obviously there's that connection there. But then also the indigenous Mapuche people in Chile, who essentially have been fighting their own, you know, centuries-long struggle against colonization and particularly extractivism. They have played a leading role in some of the demos in Chile. And, you know, they've come forward articulating the shared struggle and the need for indigenous solidarity. And so, yeah, that's in Chile, but in Colombia as well, there's been some pretty significant grassroots pressure on the government there. And it actually resulted in a pretty huge win where Colombia suspended all of its coal exports to Israel. And, you know, that just didn't just happen overnight. That was a sustained campaign from this alliance of indigenous groups in Colombia who essentially responded to a call out from Palestinian trade unions calling for a global energy embargo of Palestine. And it was, you know, it was only a few weeks after the October 7 attacks that Colombia's biggest mining workers union, they essentially called on the government to stop coal exports to Israel. But then it was finally when they joined up with indigenous groups and kept going with this sustained campaign, particularly against Glencore, the big mining giant, which is responsible for I think it's about 90% of Colombia's coal exports to Israel. There was this national day of action against Glencore, and you know ultimately it was successful It was only a few days after this national day of action that the president Petro announced that he would be suspending coal exports. And I mean that's pretty significant in the context of Israel's pretty heavy dependence on, or essentially near total dependence on, energy imports, and it's something like Colombia supplies, I think 60% of Israel's total coal imports. Well, that was last year, and so yeah, I mean it's I guess to sum it all together, there's not necessarily a massive, I guess there hasn't been any huge. There's been some big protests, but I think not on the scale that we've maybe seen in Australia or like other European countries. But I think there's a really sort of powerful parallel to be made there, between these international struggles against colonialism. And I think the Colombia example is just one, you know, quite significant example of how these international struggles can be linked up and articulated in this effective way, which is, you know, essentially what we need to turn the tide against the current complicity that we're seeing from governments, particularly Western governments like Australia, you know, the US, Germany, etc.
All right. Well, the last, getting into some of the last question I wanted to kind of ask you, what are some of your observations about the kind of growth of far-right politics that we've seen in Latin America?
So, yeah, I guess probably the most prominent example most recently would be Argentina with the sort of far right. He calls himself an anarcho-capitalist, Javier Milei, who came to power in last December. And it's a similar story to a lot of the ascendants of these far right governments or far right politicians that we're seeing across the world at the moment, which, you know, obviously the context is slightly different in different countries, but it's usually based off these figures essentially capitalizing on this huge disenfranchisement of among, you know, huge sectors of the population, among the working class, and, you know, after years of rising inequality and poverty that's been exploited by these sort of far right, you know, populist figures who you know, promise everything. That sort of real Trumpist rhetoric of blaming migrants, blaming women, blaming trans people. It's sort of, you know, the same tried and tested rhetoric. And so, you know, what we've seen with Milei since he's come to power is essentially using his executive powers to unleash attacks on the rights and, I guess, the economic situation of most Argentinians, and as well as this huge transfer of public wealth to the private sector. And that has been through privatizing a bunch of state companies, loosening labor laws, you know, big tax breaks, and sort of this, you know, classic neoliberal assault that we've seen. And even though he hasn't really been able to pass that many laws, because Congress is still controlled by his opposition, he's still, what he has managed to get through has huge ramifications for the country. And, you know, he's got the power to disband federal agencies, which he has done. He's fired tens of thousands of public sector workers, essentially condemning all these people to poverty. And, you know, but as a result of this, there's been these huge public ongoing demonstrations, which have, of course, been met with violence, you know, tear gas, water cannons, rubber bullets into, you know, injuring hundreds of protesters. And he's particularly launched a huge attack on the public university sector, which in Argentina is, you know, a rare case of free, accessible public education. And it's known all around Latin America, even the world, has some of the most high quality public education. And that's open to anyone, not just Argentinians. Anyone can go and study for free at a public university in Argentina. But what Milei's done is, you know, he's labelled these universities as hotbeds of Marxism and socialist indoctrination and whatever. So that was one of his sort of first attacks, was to basically defund these public universities. And so as a result, you've got all these universities that are in huge crisis of funding. They've had to essentially cut their student intake, cut heaps of like practical courses. A lot of them had to sort of shut down a lot of their hospitals that accompany the public universities. Even some universities have had to cut their power, essentially cut electricity during certain times and during certain areas, because they are facing such high electricity charges because inflation is so high in Argentina, and so they're not able to pay their bills, or they're essentially trying to save electricity to not be able to pay their astronomical bills. And yeah, all these universities essentially have no money. So there's been the biggest protests since Milei has come to power have been in the university sector. So workers and students, there's been huge national days of action, which Milei has predictably ignored and refused to meet their demands. But even at the moment, a lot of universities are being occupied by students and workers to essentially demand funding and stop the attacks. And, you know, I guess apart from the university sector, as I said, Milei has already slashed public spending and state subsidies for all these essential goods, which means that Argentina's poverty rate, as people, you know, are losing their pensions, losing their jobs, losing their access to community kitchens, things like that. That essentially means that the poverty has risen by at least 15% just since Milei came to power. So now it's like more than half of the population is now considered to be living in poverty. And when you look at the poverty rate in children as well, it's even starker. It's nearly reached 70%, which is obviously a huge concern. And yeah, I guess looking at Argentina, you can sort of see echoes of Bolsonaro in Brazil, a lot of the same rhetoric. Obviously Bolsonaro is not in power anymore, but speaking to comrades in Brazil who, well, you know, since he got voted out and he's not eligible to stand for re-election, you know, a lot of comrades have said, you know, this obviously isn't the end of the far right. And even if he's not the leader of it, he's still got plenty of lackeys and figureheads who are very much bolstered by what he was able to do in a few years, which was essentially, you know, unleash attacks on the working class, on indigenous groups, you know, the rates of deforestation in the Amazon just under Bolsonaro were insane. And so you've got this emboldened far right that's still continuing to advance. Brazil's just had its first round of local elections, which did see it was predicted there would be a growth of some far right parties. So they've definitely advanced in some ways, lost ground in other parts, but there's still a second round to come this month. So we'll see what happens there. But yeah, essentially you've got an emboldened far right in Brazil, and Argentina are probably the biggest examples of that at the moment.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Ben. I'll just end on one last kind of a final kind of question, and in terms of final comments. I mean, because you've covered such a great range of kind of topics in Latin American politics. I guess the last kind of question is, you know, any kind of final comments, I guess, but also in terms of your final comments, what are your thoughts, I guess, on the kind of prospects of rebuilding the left within the Latin American region?
That's a big hard question to answer. I think after in terms of rebuilding the left, I think there's so many decades of, I guess, violence and repression and specific targeting of, you know, not just people on the left, but anyone that could be vaguely considered left wing. I mean, it didn't matter. It doesn't matter to the powers that be who they kill. But you know, I think there are so many powerful examples of left alliances and left rebuilding. I think if you look at the work of the MES, which is like a radical socialist revolutionary tendency within PSOL, which is Brazil's biggest left-wing socialist party. You look at some of the work that they've done, and you know, I had the opportunity to meet a lot of comrades when I was in Brazil for a few months, in different cities, and seeing some of the real, you know, grassroots, the street level that, and the politics that they're bringing to the streets, and the campaigns that they bring. You know, they're not just electorally focused. They, you know, use elections as a platform to spread socialist ideas, to make alliances, you know, the same strategy that's really effective in spreading socialist ideas and forging alliances, essentially. So I think that's one really powerful example. I think if you look at the ongoing indigenous resistance across Latin America, particularly in the Amazon region, you know, they might not necessarily call themselves Marxists or socialists, but it's still this struggle that is very much part of, or very much at the forefront of what is required to bring about this anti-capitalist socialist revolution that is, you know, it's completely apparent that that's the only alternative we have at the moment when you look at these huge crises of poverty and of environmental disaster that capitalism brings us. I mean, there's no other alternative. And, you know, while it's a long, tough struggle, it's something that all across the continent is happening. And, you know, we're seeing that it's becoming international as well. You know, there's a huge international struggle for Palestine that's still growing, that's still building. So yeah, I think as much as things might seem bleak looking at things at face value, it's, I think resistance has always been there and will always be there. And, you know, if we can continue building, you know, stronger, broader alliances among the left, then that's what it's going to take. And I think, you know, I guess I'd take the opportunity also to encourage everyone to keep reading Green Left. I think it's really important for you know, people living in Australia or in other countries to really get informed about what's going on in the global south and in Latin America.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ben. It was great having you on our program. And yeah, looking forward to reading more of your articles and your reports from what's happening in the Latin American region. And yeah, thank you again for this interview.
Thanks, Jacob. It's my pleasure.
All right. So we're just speaking to Ben Radford, our special kind of correspondent, who's based in Peru right now, talking about a lot of the political developments that are currently happening in Latin America, you know, from the environmental crisis, the workers' strikes in Peru, the growth of the far right, and also the Palestine Solidarity Movement. So yeah, I'll just go play a quick few announcers, and we might play a quick song, and then we will might go on to our first next interview for the program soon. You're listening to Green Left Radio.